And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's topical currents. And on this Christmas Eve afternoon, Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Beautiful here in Miami, Bonnie. It's pretty chilly up north, though. I saw it was 9 degrees in St. Louis, and our guest is joining us from Pittsburgh. We visit with religious scholar and author Reza Aslan. He's written the bestseller Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. And he does join us from Pittsburgh. Welcome to you, Reza Aslan.
Thank you for having me. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you. Same to you. Reza, I'd like for us, you know, for today's program to be more about your book than about you.
okay.
But would you begin with your impetus for writing the book? You grew up in Iran, were raised in what you called a motley family of lukewarm Muslims and exuberant atheists. So,
yes, that's right.
Yeah, explain that, and please tell us more about your early years, if you would.
Yes, I was born in Iran, in Tehran, actually. My family fled Iran after the 1979 revolution. My father, who was the exuberant atheist that you're referring to, thought it might be a good idea for us to skip town for a while as things settled down in the post-revolutionary turmoil. Of course, that did not happen, and we ended up living in California, the Bay Area of California, pretty much for the last three decades. My family is still in that region. This was, of course, the 1980s. Not sure how well your listeners remember the 1980s. Wasn't exactly the best time to be Iranian or Muslim in the United States. This was the height of the Iran hostage crisis, mm-hmm. 444 days in which Americans were being held hostage in Tehran, and the anti-Iranian sentiment in the U.S. was pretty severe. And for a, you know, 7-8-year-old boy trying his hardest to not seem weird, to fit in as much as possible, it became important for me to divorce myself from my culture, my heritage, my religion, as a means of fitting in. In fact, I often say that I spent a good part of the 1980s pretending to be Mexican.
Now, who was the lukewarm Muslim? Your mom?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I think we were Muslim in a cultural sense, the way so many people all over the world are religious in a cultural sense. Islam was part of our identity. It was part of our heritage. But to be honest, I don't really remember ever going to mosque or reading the Quran. I mean, it was sort of part of our identity, part of our life, but it wasn't anything that, you know, we really focused on all that much, outside of the holidays, of course.
So in your teens, you became an evangelical Christian, and then you went back to your Muslim faith. What was behind that?
That's right.
Just fitting in?
You know, I was always deeply interested in religion and spirituality, despite the fact that, you know, I did not come from a very spiritual or religious family at all. I think it may have had partly to do childhood images of revolutionary Iran, seeing the power that religion has to transform a society for good and for bad, really seared itself in my unconscious, if you will. And so I'd always had this deep interest, as I say, in religion and in spirituality, even though I did not ever have an opportunity to really pursue that. When I was 15 years old, I went with some friends to an evangelical youth camp in Northern California, and that was where I heard the gospel story for the first time, this incredible story about the God of heaven and earth coming down in the form of a baby, dying for our sins, that those who believe in him shall also have eternal life. I'd never heard anything like this in my life. It was a profoundly transformative experience for me. I converted to a fairly conservative brand of evangelical Christianity and began preaching that gospel message as I had heard it to pretty much everyone I met, whether they wanted to hear it or not. And then when I went to university, I went to Santa Clara University and decided to start the formal study of the New Testament, I experienced what I think so many people in my situation experience, this kind of sudden realization that most of what I thought I knew about Jesus Christ was incomplete, if not incorrect, and that there was this chasm between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith. And I guess the best way to put it is that I just became more interested in the Jesus of history. That although I did eventually leave the Christian church, I delved deeply into the historical Jesus and began a lifelong study of the New Testament, of religions, and in particular the origins of Christianity.
I just am interested to know why you were more drawn to the historical, because most, I would say, well, at least Christians, which is what you were at the time, are drawn to the other Jesus that we hear, you know.
Right.
And why were you drawn more to the historical Jesus? Do you know?
I think it's a really, really good question. And part of it has to do with this, well, I would say kind of paradox at the heart of Christianity, which is the incarnation, the belief that Jesus is both fully God and fully man, which is, of course, what billions of Christians around the world believe and what I believed as well. I think the problem for me, however, is that because when you think about Jesus as also God, it becomes very difficult to think of him in his humanity. No matter how hard I tried to think about Jesus as a man, as suffering, as cold or tired or scared or anxious or nervous, there was always this sort of voice in the back of my head saying, well, yeah, but he's also God. And so it created a distance, if you will, between me and Jesus. And I know that that's an experience that some Christians have, not a lot of Christians, but for me it was a real deep experience. And so when I really dove into the historical Jesus and tried to think of him as a poor, pious peasant living in the backwoods of Galilee in the first century, and what that would mean in his time and place, the ways in which his teachings would have been shaped by the world in which he lived, the actions and the way that they were shaped by the powers of his time, the more drawn I became to him. I suppose it's about connecting to Jesus's humanity that made him more accessible, more real, more appealing to me than the notion of Jesus as divine. It's funny that, I mean, one thing that's very interesting about this question is that, you know, some people criticize the book and they will say that, well, by taking away Jesus's divinity, I've made him sort of normal and not very extraordinary. And I think the exact opposite is true. I mean, honestly, to think about the things that Jesus did and said and the impact that he had on the world, to think of a human being doing that to me is far more extraordinary than to think of a divine person doing it.
Mm-hmm. So Jesus, Bethlehem, the manger, the magi, the virgin birth, are you saying that's myth?
Oh, yes, it's definitely myth. But myth doesn't mean what you think it means. Unfortunately, in our modern parlance, myth has taken on these connotations of falsehood. But that's not what myth means. I encourage all of your listeners to get out their dictionary and look at the definition for mythology. It is not falsehood. On the contrary, myths are by their very nature always true because their truth lies beyond any kind of factual claims that they make. And that's certainly true when it comes to the gospel stories, particularly about the nativity and Jesus' birth stories. These are myths insofar as the truths that they reveal are far more important than the facts that they reveal. In fact, the facts themselves are just simply incorrect. You know, they're just historically inaccurate, and there's really no way to get around that reality. But what's important to understand is that the gospel writers who wrote these stories and the original audience that read them never thought about them in their factual sense, that the facts of the stories that they were reading were secondary to the truths that were being revealed by these stories.
So what were they? Because that was my next question. How were they received at the time? How were they regarded? How did people interpret the Gospels at the time they were written?
Not as history. Indeed, what you and I mean when we use the word history would have been completely foreign to the ancient mind. The definition of history as an accumulation of verifiable facts and dates and events is wholly a product of the modern world. That definition of history is barely 300, 350 years old. For the ancient mind, history, again, was not about revealing facts. It was about uncovering truths. So I will give you an example, which was probably quite relevant to today. You know, the story of Jesus' birth in Bethlehem. As the Gospel of Luke says, there was a Roman census of the entire world that forced all subject peoples to uproot themselves and their families from their homes, travel great distances to the lands of their fathers and their forefathers, and wait to be counted by a Roman official for taxation purposes. Jesus' family, which was in Nazareth, as a result of this, was forced to go to Bethlehem, and that's where Jesus was born. Well, the facts of that story are just not correct. Yes, there was a Roman census in the year 6 AD, though most scholars would say that Jesus was born in 4 BC, the date that the Gospel of Matthew gives instead of the Gospel of Luke. But regardless, there was a Roman census in the year 6 AD, but first of all, it was not of the Roman world. It was just of Judea, Idumea, and Perea. So in other words, it didn't even include Galilee, where Jesus lived. And most importantly, no Roman census in Roman history ever forced subject peoples to uproot themselves from the place where they live and where their property is, which is, after all, the whole point of taxation, to move to some other land that their forefathers are from. That just simply never happened. But here's the important thing. Luke, who was still a Roman citizen living under Roman dominion, knew that this does not happen. Luke's audience, which they, most of them were Roman citizens, most of them were living under Roman dominion and were regularly taxed through these censuses, knew that this is not what happened. They didn't care because the facts of the story were irrelevant to them. The truth of the story is all that mattered, and the truth of this story is that Jesus was born in the city of David, Bethlehem, the city of the Messiah, and as a result is the new David. That's what everybody would have understood by the story. No one would have read this story literally the way that we do today.
We're speaking with Reza Aslan. He's an associate professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside, a religious studies scholar and author. His latest book is entitled Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. We'd like to hear from you if you'd like to join in the conversation. It's 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576 if you'd like to speak to Reza Aslan, or you can email radio@wlrn.org.
Reza, how about the conditions in Nazareth at the time of Jesus' birth?
That's a very good question. Nazareth was such a small, such an inconsequential village, perhaps a village of maybe 100 or 200 families, that the name Nazareth does not even appear on any map until the end of the first century. This was a village of mud and brick homes, a village containing the poorest of the poor. There was no road in Nazareth. There was no public bath in Nazareth. There were no schools in Nazareth. There was no synagogue in Nazareth. And so as a result, you know, you're talking about somebody who lived in extremely poor conditions.
Do I hear little feet there?
Oh, yes, that's my little boy. Okay. That's my little son who just walked in here. Sorry about
okay.
that.
Okay, and tell us about his social standing at the time. And, of course, you say at the time there was no difference between religion and politics. So just tell us more about him at that time.
Well, if the Gospels are right in calling him a tecton, a word that is often translated as carpenter, but more correctly means builder, somebody who works in the building trade, essentially. If that's true, then that would have put him at probably the second lowest rung of the social ladder in his time, just above the slave, the indigent, and the beggar. In fact, the Romans used the word tecton as a cuss word, as a swear word. It was sort of slang for any kind of uncouth or illiterate peasant. again, just an emphasis once again about the extreme poverty of Jesus. I mean, I think there's often this sense that as a quote-unquote carpenter, he would have been considered something along the lines of a lower middle class, businessman. But that's not at all what tekton means. I often say to people that Jesus would have been less, a business owner and more the guy who stands outside of Home Depot waiting for a truck to come by for some work. Tekton was a day laborer. What Jesus would have done is every single morning he and his brothers would have, and his father would have woken up, and they would have left their village of Nazareth looking for work, looking for places that they could apply their building trade. And that sense of extreme poverty is something that permeates Jesus's teachings. I mean, it is the sum and total of his social teachings are precisely about the reversal of the social order, that the first shall be last and the first shall be, the first shall be last and the last shall be first, that the hungry shall be fed and the fed shall go hungry, that those who mourn shall rejoice, that those who rejoice shall mourn, that the rich will and the poor will literally switch places in the kingdom of God that he envisions. And as you can imagine, this was an enormously appealing message for those at the bottom of the social ladder, and at the same time, quite a threatening message for those at the top who ultimately killed him for it.
How about Jesus and his brother James versus Paul, who later became Saint Paul, and the divorce from Judaism?
Yes, unfortunately, the story of James is incredibly fascinating individual, has more or less been lost to Christian history, and quite deliberately so. But one can argue that James had as great an impact on the development of early Christianity, if not even more, than Jesus himself. After all, Jesus was in charge of this movement for 3 years. James was in charge of it for 30 years after Jesus' death. James, Jesus's brother, for those of your listeners who may not be aware, Jesus, of course, had four brothers, James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon. They're mentioned repeatedly in the New Testament. James becomes sort of the leader of the movement that Jesus leaves behind after his death. He's referred to as the Bishop of Bishops. He is in charge of what's called the Mother Assembly, that is, the church in Jerusalem, which is then, of course, in charge of all the other churches that crop up all along the Roman Empire. And he's in this position from Jesus' death until the year 62, when he himself is killed. James had what can only be described as a fairly limited view of what this movement was all about. For James, Jesus was a Jew preaching Judaism to other Jews. This was a Jewish movement through and through for James. That's not to say that non-Jews couldn't join the movement. They could, as far as James was concerned, as long as they became Jews first. Now, in the year 57 A.D., James, through a great deal of pressure from the Apostle Peter, ultimately foregoes the requirement of circumcision to join the movement, but nevertheless, he insists that to be a follower of Jesus requires one to follow the law of Moses because Jesus was a Jew preaching Judaism. Paul, of course, has a diametrically opposed view of what Jesus was all about. Now, it's important to note that Paul never actually met Jesus while Jesus was alive. Paul never spoke to Jesus. Paul's experience of Jesus comes after the resurrection, when this mystical sort of confrontation that he has with the risen Christ on the road to Damascus. And that experience propels Paul to start preaching this gospel message, not to Jews, because it was more or less a Jewish movement at that time, not to Jews, but to Gentiles. And Paul's vision of this new movement is not only not really defined by Judaism, it really divorces itself from Judaism. Paul says Christ is the end of the Torah. what he wants to do is to see the redemptive sacrifice of Jesus as essentially nullifying the law of Moses, freeing everyone from the strictures of the Torah, and instead sort of launching a wholly new religion. And James and Paul, you know, these two guys did not get along. They did not like each other very much. Now, it's important to say, just in closing here, that during the lifetime of both men, James won the argument. I mean, you don't argue with the flesh and blood brother of Jesus. During the lifetime of both men, Paul and his particular view of Christianity was quite marginal. It was a fringe kind of idea, and James's view of Christianity was ascendant. But when James dies in 62, Paul dies in 66. Jerusalem, of course, is destroyed in the year 70 by the Romans as punishment for the Jewish revolt. And along with Jerusalem is destroyed the original church of James, the Jerusalem Assembly. And at that point, it's Paul and his perception of Christianity that becomes ascendant, and James that is more or less forgotten about.
How did James die?
James was killed by what the historian Josephus refers to as this fiendish high priest in the year 62. James, what's really fascinating about him is that, you know, we actually have, take away the New Testament, and we have more historical evidence for James than we do for Jesus. James was seen as a righteous and just Jewish leader in Jerusalem. In fact, his nickname was the Just One. Very well respected, but as an advocate for the poor, was constantly in trouble with the high priesthood. And in the year 62, when the Roman governor, a man by the name of Festus, all of a sudden dies, and the next Roman governor has yet to arrive, the high priest, a man by the name of Ananus, decides to sort of take advantage of the vacuum of power in Jerusalem and start putting to death his enemies, and one of those enemies is James.
Let's work in a call before we take our break. This is Sean. He's in Miami. Hi there.
Hello. I had always considered that there was a big gap between the Jesus' story and then Paul. It's very interesting about Jesus' brother, which I didn't know about. My question pertains to how much of the story which we have, and you alluded to everything obviously being mystical and myth-based in terms of the virgin birth, but also just the fact that Jesus was a poor carpenter. Everything seemed like it was told secondhand almost 100 years later. Mm-hmm. And then to be able to kind of tie it up, and I'll take my question off the air, what sources are you pulling it from? Mm-hmm. Because obviously it's contentious stuff, and especially with James, which is something I hadn't heard of. So thank you very much, and I'll take my question up here.
Okay, thanks, Sean.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, very good question. Well, first of all, Sean, you're absolutely right that the Gospels are not eyewitness accounts of Jesus's, words and deeds. These were theological affirmations of faith written by communities of faith many years after the events that they describe. If Jesus died sometime around 30, let's say, between 30 and 33 A.D., the first gospel, the Gospel of Mark, was written sometime around 70 or 71 A.D. The next two gospels, Matthew and Luke, were written probably between 90 and 100 A.D., and then the fourth gospel, the fourth canonized gospel, the Gospel of John, was written sometime between 100 and 120 A.D. And they weren't written by Jesus' disciples. I mean, you must understand that Jesus and all of his disciples were poor, illiterate, uneducated peasants. These were farmers and fishermen. They had no idea how to read and write. They were these Gospels, and indeed most of the writings about Jesus, were written by diaspora Jews. These are sort of Hellenistic, Romanized, heavily Greek-influenced, very well-educated Jews who lived outside of the Holy Land in the Roman Empire. People like Paul, for instance. But that is not to say that we cannot glean historical evidence from the Gospels. The fact of the matter is that for some two centuries now, the methodological tools have been very well established. in helping scholars to kind of tease out what in the Gospels are more likely to be historically accurate and what's less likely to be historically accurate. And without getting too deep into exactly how the methodology works, the easiest way to put it is that we take the claims of the Gospels, we compare them to what we know about the era in which Jesus lived, first century Palestine, and we use our knowledge of that time and place to sort of challenge the veracity of the Gospel claims. So I gave a perfect example of that. The Gospel says, the Gospel of Luke talks about this census that forced the birth in Bethlehem. Well, we know a great deal about Roman census law. We know that there was no such requirement, and so therefore we know that that story is historically inaccurate. So there are ways to do this. There are definitely ways that scholars have had for years, and of course there's disagreement among scholars about, you know, which verse is more likely true and which is less likely true, but there is a good deal of consensus among scholars over what can be more or less historically relied upon when it comes to the Gospels.
We're speaking with Reza Aslan. He is a professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside. His latest book is Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, on today's Topical Currents. And we need to take a short break. We'll be right back.
And we're back on this Christmas Eve afternoon. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and also religious scholar and author Reza Aslan. We're talking about his bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Reza, why do you term Jesus a zealot?
Well, zealotry was actually a widespread phenomenon in Jesus' time. Most Jews in the first century would have proudly referred to themselves as zealous for the Lord. The term zeal is actually a biblical concept, a very old, very ancient biblical concept that implies a commitment to the sole sovereignty of God. In other words, a refusal to serve any master, certainly any human master, but any master but the master of the universe. Zealotry in Jesus' time was such a widespread phenomenon because of this quite brutal Roman occupation over the Holy Land, an occupation that for most devout Jews was seen as an abomination. After all, the Torah is about as clear as it gets. This is a land that was set aside by God solely for his chosen people, that God cannot abide by any kind of foreign or pagan presence in this land that he set aside for the Jews. And so throughout the first century, there were numerous uprisings and insurrections, many by claimants to the Messiah, who, spurred by this sense of zeal for the Lord, challenged the Roman Empire, the Roman occupation, and, of course, the priestly establishment, which had essentially married itself to Rome. And this kind of insurrection was just an ongoing thing that was constantly propping up and being crushed, until, as I say, the year 66, when it actually worked. The Jews, spurred by their zeal, did rise up against Rome, did manage to kick Rome out of the Holy Land. Of course, Rome returned a few years later and destroyed Jerusalem as punishment for the Jewish revolt. But the argument of the book is that Jesus, like so many of his fellow messiahs at the time, really exhibits the same sense of zeal that was so widespread in the first century. Indeed, so widespread that the historian Josephus refers to it as a virus that had taken hold among the people.
You mentioned the other self-proclaimed prophets of the era. Why do you think it is that Jesus's message has survived for 2,000 years? What happened to the rest of them?
Yes, I would say that this is probably the most eye-opening thing that people get out of this book, is just how many other messiahs there were in Jesus's time, preaching about, you know, the coming kingdom of God, gathering disciples, healing the sick, exorcising demons, challenging the priestly establishment, challenging Rome, and all of them were executed for their beliefs. After all, the Messiah is the descendant of King David. The principal task of the Messiah is to reestablish the kingdom of David on earth, to usher in the rule of God. Well, if you're claiming to be ushering in the rule of God, you're claiming to be ushering out the rule of Caesar, and that is a treasonable offense, which is why every single person who stood up and said, "I am the Messiah," was ultimately killed for it. And I write about a dozen of them in Jesus's time. Now, you ask a very, very good question, of course, which is, well, why is it that we have forgotten about all those other messiahs, and the only messiah that we still remember is Jesus? I think there's a couple of reasons for it, one of which is Jesus' teachings were so extraordinary. His social message, which I've described already, this reversal of the social order, had such lasting impact. And as far as we can tell, most of the other messiahs that we know anything about didn't maintain the same sense of social teachings that Jesus did. Many of them simply called for the removal of Rome, the removal of the priestly establishment, and sort of left it at that, whereas Jesus had this kind of secondary part to his messianic message, the social teachings that really resonated with a wide swath of people in his time. But the simplest answer is that the reason we still call Messiah Jesus Messiah today has less to do with anything Jesus himself said or did than it does with what his disciples said about him after his death. As I said, the principal task of the Messiah is to establish the kingdom of David. If you say you are the Messiah and you die without establishing the kingdom of David, you are not the Messiah. It's as simple as that. All the other messiahs who failed to do the Messiah's principal task were, after their death, simply declared to no longer be the Messiah. But Jesus' disciples, when confronted with this kind of, you know, problem, the fact that Jesus did not do what the Messiah is supposed to do, mm-hmm. changed the definition of Messiah, turned the Messiah into something much more spiritual, made the principal task of the Messiah a heavenly one, not an earthly one. The kingdom is celestial, not earthly. The Messiah's task is going to be taken care of in a second coming, not the first coming. All of these sort of reinterpretations of the Jewish Messiah allowed this particular movement to continue and to flourish, especially among, as I said before, non-Jews. And that's really why this particular Messiah survived, whereas the other messiahs did not.
Let's take a call or two. We've got Dave. He's in Miami. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask your guest if any parallels can be drawn between early Christianity vis-a-vis ancient Judaism and the Protestant Reformation vis-a-vis the Church of Rome in the 16th century. And I'll take your comments or answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Well, that's a fascinating question, Dave. I mean, and the reason that I like that question so much is because the fact that Christianity, as you know, as it first began, was simply an offshoot of Judaism until eventually, and particularly after the destruction of Jerusalem, it begins to divorce itself from Judaism and become its own separate religion. And I guess one could make very much the same argument about the Protestant Reformation, that this was an attempt to reform the Catholic Church that ultimately then divorced itself from the Catholic Church and became its own separate sect. So I think the parallels there are pretty good.
Do we know how Jesus viewed himself? I mean, do we know if he considered himself to be God or the Christ or the Son of God or any of those things?
Well, of course, this is the million-dollar question. I mean, you know, we know how Jesus' followers viewed him. We mm-hmm. know how his enemies in the priesthood viewed him. We know how the Romans viewed him. We know how the early church viewed him. Trying to get to the question of Jesus' self-consciousness is one that, you know, scholars have been debating for a very, very long time. And I suppose ultimately it's impossible. But really what we can do is draw some general conclusions. So, for instance, we know that very likely Jesus referred to himself as the Messiah, that he did think of himself as the Messiah. But, of course, as a Jew, when Jesus said Messiah, he would have meant the Jewish Messiah. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. And I've given the definition of the Jewish Messiah a couple of times. Right. If Jesus called himself Son of God, I think it's very important to understand that Son of God is not a description. It's a title. Many people are called Son of God in the Bible, none more often than King David. Son of God actually is a title for kings. So if Jesus called himself Son of God, and I think very few scholars would say that he did, but if he did call himself Son of God, what he meant was that he was king, not that he was literally the begotten Son of God. That would have been a completely new interpretation of the Son of God. Did Jesus think of himself as divine? Well, again, I think it's important to understand that the key to understanding who the historical Jesus was lies in his Jewishness. Jesus was a Jew preaching Judaism to other Jews. And the notion of a divine man is anathema to everything Judaism has ever said, thought, believed, or written about either God or man. It just absolutely contradicts the very core of what Judaism is. Is it possible that Jesus was the first Jew in history to think of himself as divine? Yes, it's possible. Is it likely? No, it's not likely. And I think that is the dividing line between the person of faith and the historian. The person of faith is interested in what is possible. The historian is interested in what is likely.
It's an interesting way of putting it. We're speaking with Reza Aslan, and he is a religious study scholar and author. His latest book is Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. One last break and we'll return.
And we return. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and also religious scholar and author Reza Aslan. We're talking about his book Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. He's joining us from Pittsburgh. Let's take a call. This is from Key Biscayne, Father Bob. Hi.
Hi, Bob Libby. Yes, sir. I'd like to talk to Dr. Aslan.
You're on.
Dr. Aslan, I've read your books, both your books, and the scholarship. I want to question you about the scholarship, which is based on the writings, to a large extent, of Dr. Albert Schweitzer, who challenged the or proposed the division between the Christ of history and the Christ of faith. And that is really quite old-fashioned. In the last 40 or 50 years, biblical scholars like Dr. Bishop N.T. Wright have challenged that and said that the Jesus of history and the faith, Christ of faith, are not that far apart. And also that the teaching of James and the teaching of Paul were worked out at the Council of Jerusalem. And I just wondered if you wanted to respond to that.
Yes, thank you. Well, first of all, it is true that Albert Schweitzer, in many ways, launched the so-called quest for the historical Jesus 200 years ago. But there have probably been about 200,000 scholars who have written about the historical Jesus since Albert Schweitzer. So it's just simply incorrect to say that anyone who writes about the historical Jesus is dependent on Albert Schweitzer. There's been an enormous amount of work done, particularly in the last 50, 60 years, in trying to uncover the historical Jesus and to separate him from the Christ of faith. N.T. Wright, whom I'm a great fan of, does a wonderful job as a Christian theologian, which I am not, as a Christian theologian in reconciling the sort of very clear divisions that exist between the Christ of faith and the Jesus of history. And I think that any Christian who wants to, you know, get an answer, a theological answer for how to reconcile these two figures, can do no better than Bishop Wright. He's a remarkable theologian, a wonderful thinker, and a great writer.
But he's also a historian.
No, he's not a historian. He's
yes,
a theologian.
Yes, he is. He started
and I'm
out
not
as,
a theologian.
He started out as a historian of ancient cultures, and from there he moved into the biblical studies. So he was looking at the biblical history from the terms of how history was written and transmitted at the time, first century. Now,
well,
I know you've read his work
because
you have, him in your bibliography. The other thing I would challenge is some of your dating. You date all the Gospels after the fall of Jerusalem, and that,
yes,
that is something, and you state that as a fact accepted by general scholarship. Where,
yes,
did you do? Where did you get your PhD in biblical studies?
My PhD is in religious studies from UC Santa Barbara, and the fact that all the Gospels were written after 70 is one that 99% of all biblical scholars agree on. That is really not up for debate. Two-source theory upon which...
Wait a minute.
Let him respond one at a time, please.
Okay.
The two-source theory upon which that notion is based is a theory, absolutely, but I often say it's a theory the way that evolution is a theory. It's a pretty good theory, and I would say that the vast, vast majority of scholars would agree with it. There are some that do not. I can name a few right now. Marcus Borg, for instance, Martin Dibelius, for instance. But more or less,
how about
that
Andy
is
Robinson?
The general consensus that all the Gospels were written after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70. To the larger point, though, let me just emphasize one very important thing, and I've sort of talked about this already. There is a fundamental dividing line between the Christ of faith and the Jesus of history. And that dividing line is that the Jesus of history was a Jew preaching Judaism to other Jews. And if you agree with that statement, then it changes the way that you understand the nature and the function and the interpretation of Jesus' teachings. If you do not, if you believe that the Jesus of history, was sort of divorced from his Jewish heritage, that he was preaching something profoundly new, that he was utterly unique in the way that he thought about his religion, his identity, the definition of Messiah, that is a perfectly valid interpretation of Jesus, and it's one that N.T. Wright certainly has, but it's not one that I share. And I think that's the important thing to understand here. Do you believe that Jesus was utterly unique, that what he was preaching was unlike anything Judaism had ever thought about before? Or do you believe that he was extraordinary, but that his views on his faith, the Torah, the temple, and the world in which he lived was very much within the mainstream? I believe in the latter. N.T. Wright believes in the former.
Father Bob, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you so much.
We have to run.
Thank you for calling. Reza, I'd like to know why you wrote the book. Why do you think it's important for others to understand Jesus the man and his time and place in history more than Jesus in the church view, Jesus Christ or the Son of God? Or
well, I
God.
Guess I had two. I guess I had two audiences for the book. I mean, I certainly had a faith-based audience in mind, and I kind of described what I wanted to do with that earlier, in that I wanted to give those who believe that Jesus is both God and man a sense of what the man part meant by putting it in his time and place, that if mm-hmm. you really want to know Jesus the man, then you need to know the world in which he lived in, and this is a book about that world. But secondly, I had a non-faith audience in mind, too. And for them, I wanted to answer the question that I get all the time from atheists, from non-Christians, which is, what is the big deal about this Jesus guy? And this is a book to sort of explain what the big deal is, that regardless of whatever faith statement you want to make about Jesus, that the bare-bones facts of his life are extraordinary and make him worth knowing. What you are talking about when you talk about the Jesus of history is a poor, illiterate, uneducated, pious Jewish peasant from the backwoods of Galilee who started a movement on behalf of the poor, the dispossessed, the marginalized, the outcast, a movement that was seen as such a threat to the political and religious authorities of his time that he was hunted down like a criminal, arrested, tortured, and executed for sedition against the state. You call him Bob if you want to. That seems like a man worth knowing. That seems like a man worth following, regardless of whatever theological claims you may make about him. And that's really what I wanted to explain to an audience, that the Jesus of history is every bit as compelling and charismatic and worth knowing and following as the Christ of faith.
Well, notwithstanding the Fox interview, with Lauren Green, I think was her name, how has your book been received by and large by the Christian community and by others?
Oh, it's overwhelmingly positive. I think there's this impression that somehow there's been a Christian backlash against the book. That's simply not true. Certainly there has been a backlash from very conservative Christian groups, evangelical groups, right-wing groups, but the vast majority of emails that I get from Christians are enormously positive. I get dozens of emails a week from Christians telling me that the book has actually empowered their faith, that while they believe that the man I am describing is also God, that they have never had an opportunity to kind of understand the extraordinary nature of what he was doing based on the time and place in which he lived. And I think that's a great feeling to have.
Well, it's been a very pleasant hour.
Well, thank you so much. Reza Aslan is an associate professor of creative writing at University of California, Riverside. He's a religious studies scholar and author. And this book we've been discussing today is Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thanks for listening. Our producer, Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer, Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Best wishes for happy holidays, and to you, Bonnie.
And to you, and to all of you.
We'll be back Thursday with the popular restaurant Roundabout with Linda Gassenheimer, Jen Kuretic, and critic Jan Morris from Palm Beach. To the calendar, on this day in 1922, 91 years ago, the birth of actress Ava Gardner in Grabtown, North Carolina. A voice coach tamed her almost incomprehensible southern accent. Magambo, the barefoot Contessa, the night of the iguana on the beach. And on this day in 1943, 70 years ago, President Roosevelt appoints General Dwight Eisenhower Supreme Commander of Allied Forces. He carried out D-Day and the subsequent invasion of the European continent. One more while we remember the brother in Lawford. On this day in 1984, 29 years ago, the death of actor Peter Lawford in Los Angeles. He was married to JFK's sister Patricia from 1954 to 66, then was later estranged from Rat Pack pal Frank Sinatra. They had first worked together on the musical It Happened in Brooklyn. And we leave with this from Ava Gardner, who was married to Mickey Rooney, Artie Shaw, and Frank Sinatra, quote, I think the main reasons my marriages failed is that I always loved too well, but never wisely. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.